It's actually so nice to be able to stop. To be able to stop and not having to do anything. It's become such a luxury in our lives, you know, that we've forgotten what tremendous joy can be in just stopping and being still. So our lives are filled with all kind of activities during the day, in our everyday life, as it is called, as though that was the real life, the world out there. And that starts to feel just so normal, so, to speak, natural, that we are always busy, always, or nearly always, occupied with something. Some kind of duty, something we have to do, something we have to gain, somewhere we have to go. Of course, somebody to ring, somebody to meet, somebody to wave goodbye, somebody to say hello to. All these things going on, and we feel the busyness and we feel the importance of our own life. And of course we feel alive, or we think we feel alive in all of that busyness. And there is some truth to that. And yet, when coming in a retreat situation like this, where all these stimulations suddenly fall away, one can almost feel like lost in all of that, lost in that stillness. All that what seemed to be important is suddenly not there anymore. That which made me important before, you know, just not there. No telephone calls, no emails, no dates, except for the schedule, of course. And then our sense of who we are is tremendously, or can be tremendously, challenged through stopping, through becoming still. Today is the third full day of this retreat. And I'd really like to express my deep appreciation for the commitment everyone here has made to actually practice together, to explore this way of deep stillness, this way of cultivating wisdom, clarity, and compassion. It's not easy at all, because it really, in some mysterious and very subtle ways, challenges our identity, our sense of who we think we are. So really, this form of meditation and this practice we are undertaking here, very profound. If we practice it like this, in a way, no stone stays unturned. We can question anything in our life and look at it. How much truth is in it? How much truth is in my beliefs and the way I live, in my thoughts, in any sense of what I hold to be true, or what I was told to hold for true? And sometimes it might be that we say, oh, well, actually, this is quite true. So I just put back the stone as it was. And sometimes we look at the stone we've picked up and say, whoa, actually, if I really and honestly look at it, maybe it's not quite the way I thought it is. Maybe what I considered to be important in my life before is not really that important. Maybe if I look at my relationship with somebody, it's actually not such a deep friendship as I always thought it is. Maybe there's a lot of tension in this relationship if I really, truly and honestly look at it. But I've never done that before because I was just continuing in my busyness of everyday life. And so either I keep on looking at the stone or I quickly put it back because I don't really want to see it. And so in the silence we can look, we can inquire. And really the technique of mindfulness that we've been introducing here over the last few days is a wonderful way of exploring and really experiencing our lives as they are in a moment-to-moment basis. That means really experiencing. It's not thinking about it. It is experiencing it. Experiencing this body. Experiencing emotions, thoughts, concepts, ideas, beliefs. Not philosophizing about it. Not conceptualizing about it and endlessly talking about it. And one opinion against the other one, and who is better, and who is the better speaker, you know, and the one who is the more powerful speaker than the other one, in the end will win the argument, but may not really convince the other person. May just be the winner of the moment, but actually there's still some tension, there's not much wisdom then. But what we do here is really deeply stay with the actual experience of the moment. And that experience might be just a very happy moment, a moment of spaciousness, a moment of love, or a moment of freedom. Or it could be a moment of quite some difficulties, pain, anxieties, worrying. The great challenge in this practice is very much to stay calmly with whatever that comes. Not so much wishing for a particular and bringing us into some lovely space, you know, of pinky clouds or whatever, pure white light, and so on. But it's more about being with actually the truth of the experience of the moment, as simple as that. And this can lead us to very deep, very clear places in our lives, to clear understanding of that unfolding process of life that we are part of, that we are not separate from. It's organic life that we are all part of. You know, it's not something out there in nature or something, but actually we are nature. Maybe it is possible to get a very deep sense for that. That nothing really is separate from what we perceive as my own existence, my life. But really, this life has come as an expression of all of life. And therefore, all living forms, all living beings, have got much more in common than what separates them. Of course, there's a truth of uniqueness of every human being, of every animal, every plant. It's a unique appearance into form. Going through birth, coming up and flowering. Remember this wonderful quote of Krishnamurti that Stephen read out last night. Things come into form and they can flower. So do we. And then withering. And then slowly disappearing again. It's just the way we live. There's this rhythm of life in it. And it's not like any one of us could just come out of the blue into this life, of course, but we come according to certain conditions. Our life unfolds according to condition, and we ourselves influence the lives of other beings as well. So we're really in this web of life. And it looks like this is not only the case for what we see as our outer life, the way we go through life, but also our inner life very much. Mm-hmm. Emotions, thoughts, mind states do not just pop out of the blue, are there, yes, like pressed into us, or somebody has done this and now I'm angry. But they're appearing and they're disappearing. There's a constant coming and going in a way. There's much more movement in all this inner life than we probably have really seen yet. Sometimes when if a state of mind is very strong, it can be almost like glasses we look through. We see everything through a certain pair of glasses, and a pair of glasses like anger or greed or doubts or sleepiness or restlessness. And then something happens and this state of mind changes and the whole world suddenly looks different again. And yet we've put so much identity at that moment into a state of mind that we really believe this is who I am. So tonight I would like to say a little bit more about greed, anger, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubts, which are really the very classical glasses, so to speak, states of mind that can cause a lot of difficulties, not only on a retreat, but in general in our lives. And these are states of mind that we just all too easily misunderstand as who I really am. So if we look at them a bit closer, it might help to find some clarity in it. One thing that really struck me in the last few days is the degree of tiredness and exhaustion among many many people here in this room, and very understandably, in a life that is full of busyness, one actually doesn't allow oneself really time for being tired. It's come as far as that, as it seems, that we have such full days that we even don't have time for being tired. So we just go on doing, and then in the evening fall into bed, can sleep off immediately, or sometimes can't sleep. And so keep on thinking all night through, get up in the morning and back into our busyness of the daily lives. And somehow we manage to get through of that with one very, very small quantities of sleep. And what can happen then is really that basic level of tiredness just establishes itself. Just establishes itself and becomes part of our daily life. Like being always tired somehow. What a shame. Shame not even to take enough time for getting enough rest. To sleep enough. Yes. Basic need to body and mind to get enough sleep. And how come? If we inquire into our lives, how come, and really you and me too, I also live quite a busy life, how come that we don't even take enough time for rest? What has happened that we don't sleep enough? When we come here and there's no demands, no outer stimulation, no energizing dates and appointments and nothing that holds us up awake, and then suddenly really this wave of tiredness is coming up. The wave of tiredness is coming and one can hardly stay awake at all. So if that's the case, it's very hard to do anything. There's no remedy that can instantly, you know, cure this in a way. Sometimes all we can do is actually take a good rest, take a sleep, take an extra hour of sleep to, you know, and one won't get all the sleep that would be needed in just a few days now. It is actually a basic issue, or can be a basic issue, to have a change in life, to allow oneself enough rest. On the other hand, even if one has slept enough, even if one, you know, is not affected by this phenomenon, but actually came here quite rested, you know, it might be one comes into this place and nothing great is happening, one's just stopping and sitting still, and then suddenly a wave of tiredness is coming in. Yes. And one actually got up quite refreshed in the morning, and you sit down and looking forward to the meditation, and then closing the eyes, 5 minutes gone into the meditation, whoosh. There's this nodding meditation, quite regularly, nodding off. That's so common. It's happening quite regularly. And there are few things we can actually do to help the mind to stay awake. Stay awake. So one thing would be, for example, to open the eyes, to get up into standing meditation, and then sit down again quietly and with respect for the silence in the room, and start afresh again and again. And yet, you know, sometimes actually we come into this space of tiredness. And there's nothing one can do at that moment. And actually, one can either just give up and slip into sleep for a moment, or make that sleepiness the object of meditation. And here we would be right in the middle of a classical exploration. In the Buddhist teachings, it's one of the so-called hindrances. Wow. It's not really one of my favorite words, but I'd like to mention it anyway. So it's one of the classical hindrances to deal with what is called there sloth and torpor. And it is very similar to sleepiness, and it actually leads into sleepiness, but quite often, and that's interesting about it, it's not really because we are tired, but because we actually, in the meditation or in our inner awareness, come to a place that is somehow uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, in an area that we don't really want to see. Oh no, leave me alone. It's a begging. Leave me alone with this issue. I don't really want to see it. So go to sleep. Maybe some one or two have experienced that. Huh? If that is the case, First thing would really be not to judge oneself too harshly for that, because actually we are in a different place, in a difficult place then. This is an edge, this is an inner edge. That means the edge, inner edges, they connect that which we can see and that inside ourselves which we rather not want to see. And so the edge is the line between it, so to speak, if we want to look at it as an image. And at this edge, one sometimes falls asleep. So, because, why actually, why does one fall asleep at the edge? It is because it is somehow a little bit frightening to our identity. It is a little bit frightening to our egos. It's a little bit frightening to our sense of who I think I am. I don't really want to see that part there on that side. So I really just stay with this side. Don't want to look over the fence. And yet, there's also a certain yearning, a human yearning for expansion, for inner expansion, for actually looking beyond what we perceive as I, me, and myself. So it's really that tension between wanting to be on the secure side of a secure identity and the yearning for a deeper meaning in life, a deeper understanding, a deeper reconnection with the oneness, with the interconnectedness, a remembering of that oneness of nature that we are all part of. So if we are on this edge of exploration, what can really be helpful is to be kind with ourselves, be reaffirming with ourselves, to look a little bit over the fence, but also, you know, to reconfirm in a way, yes, I'm still here, and that's quite regularly, you know, it's not like a breakthrough and I've got it, but it's sometimes a very gradual expansion of what we can take at a time. So the ego, you know, wants a reconfirmation, a what one perceives as security. And mind you, this is really just a help. This is not an end in itself, but this is a trick in a way to look deeper, to step by step find the trust and find the courage to look completely over the fence. Of course, if one is blessed with big mind from the beginning, you know, one doesn't need these little techniques. Or sometimes one has got just big mind, one just remembers big mind. You know, it's not something we need to build up necessarily, but big mind can be there anyway. But quite often, actually, one is not really immediately in that space. One doesn't immediately remember big mind. But, you know, there's a lot of holding, a lot of security needed, because trust hasn't really been established yet. The trust that we are actually in the web of life. We can't get lost out of, we can't fall out of life. You know, we are part of this ever-unchanging process, and we can trust our own experience, we can trust that there's a place for us on earth, we can trust our capacities as human beings to find full freedom. But as long as these are just words, and we don't remember them in this inner exploration, I think it's perfectly fine to employ these little tricks, these little helps, to go on with the exploration, go on with the practice, rather than going back and falling asleep, falling into sloth and torpor, as it is called, you know. Just starting again, waking up gradually is one way of walking on this path to freedom. So trust is a tremendously important quality. To remember trust, faith would be another word for it, confidence in the practice, surrender in the practice. It's not so much like, I am a meditator, I am going to have a big breakthrough and then all the suffering is over and done with. You know, that doesn't work, unfortunately. It doesn't work. That's full of ambition. That's a big meditator's ambition and ego in that. And there's a lot of suffering in it as well. But it's more a softening into experience, a trusting into experience. And that trust that we can nurture also helps tremendously in times of great difficulties, and of course also in times of small difficulties, because suffering is not always just terrible difficulties, but dukkha can also mean unsatisfactoriness. The daily unsatisfactoriness that we experience here and of course outside a retreat as well, just anything really has got some unsatisfactoriness in it. You know, just if you look at the body or experiencing the body, you know, just the you know, there is no lasting happiness to be found in the body, however pleasant any body experience might be, however pleasant, for example, some music might be that we are hearing, however pleasant a sight of something might be, a sight of a beautiful flower, for example, might be. You know, it is absolutely for sure it will come to an end, and we need to let go of that pleasantness. You know, there's no lasting satisfactoriness in it. So we can't hold on to a moment of relative happiness there. So there's a little bit of unsatisfactoriness in it. But if you got trust that actually there is nothing that goes through this movement of coming and going, as if you've got the trust that and the knowing that there's nothing we can hold on to, nothing we can really find in it that will give us everlasting happiness and satisfactoriness. But there's a trust in our own experience and our own awareness. Then we can just be with that dance of life, with that ever unfolding of life, without having to fix it and to hold it and make this really my identity, my happiness. And it's mine, it's not yours, it's mine. Why should we do that then? Sometimes the world doesn't make any sense at all to the thinking mind, to the logical mind. And this is in particularly a place where trust or faith is required. It doesn't mean a blind kind of faith, you know, just trusting anybody, the great guru, or the great teaching, or this and that and the other. And you know, it doesn't mean to be stupid in that faith, but it means really a deep sense of trust. In our own experience. It's not into anything out there, it's in our own experience. And the trust also gives a lot, or can give a lot of energy for this inner practice, for this way, and for our actions in the world as well. It's a trust that actually I don't need anything from outside. there's nothing I can get that I haven't got already. There's an innate great perfection in every living being. But really, you know, really just sometimes it's just to sit and from time to time remember the word trust. And where can it be found in the body? Do you know where trust lives in the body? If not, then I would invite you to make that an investigation in the meditation. Where can you actually feel trust in the body? Another classical hindrance to our peace of mind is restlessness. And really, restlessness is such a state, isn't it? I mean, one is, comes to the meditation and sits down and the body seems to have so much energy. And it's not in accordance with the calmness of mind. You know, they are not in balance, the steadiness of mind and the energy in the body. And there's great tension. And the body just wants to get up and get out, or wants to slip out of the skin. There's something to happen, somewhere to go, to dance, to whirl, to do something, run around, whatever. Or there's so much, or the mind is so fully charged, there's all kind of wild thinking going on, and fantasizing, and dialoguing. You know, that's another state of mind, this restlessness. So, how do we deal with that? It's again a state of mind where we very much put our identity into, where we think, well, I am really, you know, I need to do this. What I really need is some more exercise, and I need some different practice, and I need to go here, and I need to go back to Tel Aviv, or I need to whatever it might be. Can you hear there's a lot of again a lot of self in it, and yet it's just a state of mind. It's according to certain conditions, and we can again make that a field of our exploration in our being here. Do we really have to believe this restlessness? We can only explore these states of mind if we really turn our attention to them and open to them. It's not like wishing them away or saying, well, this is restlessness, this is sleepiness, I know you, you're a hindrance, I've heard, and so I'll just let go of you and don't bother me anymore, I know this is all just an illusion. Yeah. But to turn to them and look at them, and really I think that it is important to generate some compassion for that self, for oneself in this situation, when one is really in the state of restlessness. This is so unpleasant, isn't it? And where can we hold ourselves in that? Where can we actually nourish ourselves? Where can we hold ourselves and say, well, yes, this is difficult. You are really in a restless situation or state of mind, restless state of mind. Is it possible to stay there, to look at it, to really explore it completely in the body, in the mind, in the heart? Is it possible to really deeply understand what it actually means to be restless? Just looking at it, like a scientist, if you want to, but with a big heart, not with a small heart, with a big heart. Because one can really get, you know, from any difficult state of mind, just all too easily into the state of mind of blaming oneself, or I'm really not doing well, I'm again in this restlessness, you know, and I shouldn't be in the restlessness, and it's my fault I'm again into restlessness because I still really haven't understood what it is all about. And look at everybody else, they're all sitting so calmly here in the room, you know, and nobody is struggling with restlessness, you know, it's just me, and certainly I'm also the only one who fell asleep this morning, you know, everybody else is so very awake and free from any kind of thinking, you know, and nobody in any kind of difficult emotions, and you know, one can really build up that kind of story inside oneself. But I think, you know, if we could listen to everyone's thoughts in this room during just one sitting, shoo, oh my God, you know, it's actually, maybe we're blessed not to listen to everyone's thoughts and thinkings and ideas about everyone else here. Sometimes take these states of mind that are thinking just really far too personal. But it's just a state of mind. It's happening to almost everyone at all, you know, at a certain point of time. It's a phenomenon. It's an energy field. It's a form of energy, of mental energy. And we can, if we experience it, we can make that the object of our exploration. And through this, through that compassionate exploration, really, it is important to nourish the compassion and the precision in this practice. Both go together. They need to go together. Then we can understand. Then we can easily discover it when it's there, and look right through it. And we don't need to be torn or blown away if restlessness comes. But we can look even deeper, look under the restlessness. Sometimes we can discover quite a bit of worry or anxiety under restlessness. So this is the next layer in the emotional world. How do I relate then to that? Where can I feel it in the body? Where can I feel it in the breath? Can I embrace it? Can I hold myself with a compassionate heart when I go into the next layer and look at it? What else is there? I sometimes really like to think of this compassion we need to nourish as a very, very positive form of mothering oneself. I know this word mother is so charged, unfortunately. And yet, you know, is it possible within ourselves and for ourselves to find this really holding and supportive energy, you know, that is actually encouraging, that is not holding back for one from unknown territory, but actually that is encouraging one and holding one to look even closer and even deeper. And then we can discover that all these mental conditions are part of that ever unfolding process. They're coming and going. They're coming and going. And they seem to be so real at the moment when they're there, and a moment later they're gone. And all our identity, our ego we've put into them, is gone with it. And there's already something else we've suddenly put our identity into. And something else is coming, and something else is coming. So where can I put my trust into if everything is coming and going? Where can I rest? Where's home? That's a question to reflect on. Aversion is such a big field of exploration, and certainly it's one of the hindrances. It's one that I think quite a few have experienced here, but we experience that actually can experience at any time. Aversion has got many, many different faces, and it's really a good idea to become very familiar with the energy of aversion when it's there. It's one thing, and rather easy, to talk about aversion when it's not there, to philosophize about aversion and the end of aversion, the end of hatred, the end of anger, the end of boredom and ill will. But it's a whole different story when we are right in the middle of it, because it's such a strong energy, isn't it? So, and it feels so real. Again, there's so much of ourself that we put into it, and believe this is who I am, and there's a heat in it as well, and it's a strong body feeling. There can even be something like a strange form of lust in anger. You know, one feels really energized by anger. So therefore it is very important to become deeply familiar with aversion. One can be quite aversive, aversion. Or can somebody translate aversion? How many words were that? Yeah. I find it quite interesting that boredom, for example, is also a subtle form of aversion. Yeah? Or guilt. One is really beating oneself. Oh, I'm to blame, you know, I'm the guilty one. It's all my fault. What a form of really aversion towards oneself. You know, or equally, it's his fault. He's the one to blame. If he hadn't done that, we would all be in a much better position. Gosh, you know, hard to breathe in that. And yet, probably something, it's just a very common experience, and it's something that is not easy to explore, because it is so charged with heat and energy, and has a tendency to, first of all, to throw one's aversion against somebody else. The Buddha, we were talking about that last night in a small round, and I was remembering that Buddha, that image that the Buddha gave is, if we throw out our aversion or our anger against somebody else, that is really like picking up a piece of hot coal, charcoal, and throwing it at the other person. And the other person might get burned by it, but my own hand is burned first. It's not possible to hit somebody else without hitting ourselves. Even though one might feel very right and just at that moment, and yet anger or aversion has got that potential to burn our own hand. And so it's really a deep and important practice to get to know aversion very intimately. Not, you know, it doesn't help to say, oh well, this is really aggressive, I don't want to have anything to do with that, you know, and I don't want to see this part of my life, I don't want to be an aggressive person, after all I'm now a spiritual person. You know, but aversion is hot stuff. So if I notice an aversive state of mind, how can I deal with that? How can I become very familiar with that? It's like, actually, like always, through the body. That's also why we've put so much emphasis on mindfulness of breath and body in the last few days. Really, so much of the wisdom can be discovered through the body, not so much through the intellectual thinking about it, although that is also a wonderful human tool that we can employ, but that's only one small part of our human capacity. Lots of the exploration can go directly through the body. So if I want to look at aversion, where can I feel it in the body? Is it in the arms? Is it in the fist? Is it in the belly? Is it in the knees? Or in the legs? Where can I feel the aversion when it's there? That can be part of meditation. And if I feel it in the body, how does it feel? feel like? What does it feel like? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it dense? Is it spacious? Is it changing? Is it prickling? Whatever that might be. Does it wander through the body or does it stay in one place? How does it influence the breath? Is breath changing in any way? Is breath more rough or more smooth, or do I stop breathing all in all? Or what's the state of my mouth? Am I showing my teeth, for example? Yeah. Is there any tension here in the jaws? These are all things we can explore. We can really stay in contact with ourselves in the midst of anger. That can be quite helpful. Because one stays in the here and now and can relate again to the body and the breathing and know from a place of stillness there's anger. Sometimes it needs a lot of mindfulness of breathing in the midst of anger to not automatically follow that impulse of pushing into somebody else's face or be in any way destructive, either outwardly or inwardly. Anger can actually turn towards ourselves. You know, if we try not to pour it onto somebody else, but it's actually not completely seen and embraced with a big heart, but just put under the carpet somehow for the time being, and then we forget about it, and actually it can turn against ourselves, and we can become quite destructive in our own life. Destructive behavior. I mean, there are so many forms and patterns of self-destructive behavior. Have you ever smoked a cigarette and really done that mindfully? And really noticed actually the pain it causes in the lungs? Or smoke 10 cigarettes? How does that feel afterwards? The pain that causes in the lungs? You know, this is not about you make you feel guilty, not at all. You know, it's just, this is about being really aware of what we are doing towards ourselves. Self-destructive behavior. Or ever really drunken too much and the feeling the next day? That is something, you know, that is an aggressive part in that towards oneself. You know, so I don't say don't do that. It doesn't make sense at all. You're all adults. But to see what do I do against myself? And in the same way, of course, then starting to see what do I do towards my partner, towards my family. Being so slowly becoming aware of aversive patterns maybe in our lives, aversive mind states. When we, you know, and we can discover them more and more intimately and quicker when we become familiar with them. Aversion is not who we are, it's a state of mind. Let's really keep that in mind. And we can find that out through the exploration. And the exploration needs to come with trust, needs to come with a compassionate heart, big compassionate heart, because this way is not easy. And it's not just all about discovering and say, oh, this is aversion and this is restlessness and this is sleepiness and greed and doubt, but also to look through it and discover something within ourselves that is actually completely free, has always been free, will always be free. It's a place where we can rest in awareness. It's a place where we can, where we are actually truly at home. It's where there's clarity. A place that is always and has always been free from the slightest trace of aversion. It is free from the slightest trace of aversion in the midst of aversion. It can be there and still, you know, there's a dimension in ourselves that is absolutely free from that. So maybe this is enough for tonight. Gives us a lot to reflect on and to explore, and I would really like to encourage and invite all of us to stay with these questions, to find the courage to go deeply into the discovery of our own lives and into the and allowing the heart to soften and to flower and to embrace all of life. So let's just sit together for a few minutes silently, please.